Welcome to this edition of This Is Design Intelligence, conversations with leadership voices in the built environment. This edition is sponsored by the Tricord Group, leading successful relationship constructs for over 25 years, and VIM, helping the architecture and design disciplines design, deliver, and operate better buildings for a better world.
Greetings, I'm Dave Gilmore, and this is Design Intelligence. Joining me in the studio today is an esteemed panel of technology leaders within the architecture industry. We have Shane Berger from Woods Bagot. We have Roberta Kowalshin from Dialog Design. We have Holly St. Clair from Sasaki. And we have Nick Cameron from Perkins & Will. Thank you all for joining me in the studio today. It's great to have you here. All four of you are doing wonderful work. You're representing amazing organizations, but most importantly, we're depending on you across this industry for your leadership, your insights, your inspiration as well. You have tough jobs in this space. You know, when we look at so much that's out there, we talk about trends that we're seeing with architects using technology. That capability of the tools far outstrips what we're actually getting out of them. It's not that individuals in the field aren't smart and creative and really tech savvy. It just seems to be that groups fail to use all the human capacity or the tech firepower, if we could put it that way, they have at their disposal. And so it seems that simply hiring smarter or buying or building more technology isn't what's really making the difference. Do you agree with that assessment? And what do you think needs to change in the firms or among the firms so that we get the most out of our technology and our human capabilities and capacities? Let me begin with you, Shane. Any thoughts around some of these thoughts that I've just offered?
Yeah, I think one of my concerns that I see within any practice in architecture is a general level of complacency or a feeling that someone else in the firm is the one who should be in charge of innovation or change. You know, with my focus on technology, there's a feeling that there's the technology people and they're the ones that are going to do that. And sometimes also this lack of recognition that the change that's going on in our industry has moved from an episodic sort of thing that comes every few years to one of continuous change. And firms have not really positioned themselves to take advantage of that, to learn the new technologies that have been provided to them out there. They're not keeping pace with the sorts of things that are being presented to them, but also not taking the initiative within themselves to really dig in, to have skin in the game with that change, to make a determination to help influence where the industries are going in terms of technology, in terms of delivery, in terms of client interaction. I think we've sat back too often in a passive position and said, well, I'll wait till the next version of whatever BIM tool comes out there for me to make a change at that point, rather than actively engaging and saying, this is what we think needs to happen in the industry. And we're either going to develop our own prototypes and build it ourselves, or we're going to try to influence our peers or those who are kind of software vendors or those who are making those changes to do the things that we're interested in. It's this lack of interest of continuous development, of learning and development, and just thinking that it's other people's jobs to do it and that, you know, I don't need to do it myself. And I think this is one of the big things I'm trying to change within my practice, and I hope to see in more and more practices out there, is that that level of change and interest in innovation, interest of embedding technology has to be pervasive in every position of the company. And we all have to be looking out for what's coming next, but also actively involved in determining what's coming next.
Great response. Roberta, I'm guessing that you are in a similar vein of thought as Shane around some of this. Some comments to add on to that?
Yeah, I will, you know, first start by saying I'm in company of some industry expertise that many of you know I don't have. I'm 3 years into this industry, so sometimes that's a benefit and sometimes it's a curse. A lot of my comments will be from someone who spent years in media, financial services, network services, cybersecurity, and now I'm 3 years into a very different world. So outside-in perspective, I take it for what it's worth. But it's been very interesting joining this industry, which is, you know, in many cases motivated by artistry, the greater good of community well-being, which is our firm, and types of goals that have not been that common in some of the other places I've worked. And artists and that sort of sensibility of what we're building and how it's making the world a better place, I think, which we all see many, many times, doesn't sometimes have the same kind of sensibility that you would find in a high-tech company, which is, I need to learn the next thing, I need to get it moving and in production quickly, and I need to get value from it quickly. And so I think there's sort of a fundamental culture difference in sort of how we see technology versus how an artisan sort of puts their work together. And, you know, and I'll use that term artisan because the only thing I can compare it to in 3 years, because I have a strong long-term interest, I was used to sew when I was younger in fashion, is that, you know, the industry shifted from couture, handmade, beautiful, you know, garments years ago, to sewing machines and building things that were more mass production. And we're sort of in a bit of that today with our industry. And it's a real mind shift to go from hand crafting something to say, well, I'm going to use some components, some modules, some materials, some products, some routines that someone else has already put in place for me. And I think that, as well as sort of the artistry, is kind of this mind shift, which has been really interesting as I've kind of new and joined this industry. So that's kind of my take on it. We see the same thing as Shane. For sure. We have some programs that try to draw our larger population beyond technology into what we're doing. But in the end, Shane's absolutely right. It sort of lands back with, hey, tech's got this covered for us, you know.
It happens, doesn't it? It seems I've been watching that across the firms. As soon as we say, and just in the last couple of years, I've seen firms in a different context appointing a chief EDI officer, equity, diversity, inclusion officer or director. And suddenly the human nature goes, phew, somebody else is going to deal with that. And EDI by nature is something that you make a choice every single day when you wake up as a human being. It's not something to outsource, right? But more often than not, we're seeing that kind of dynamic. You see it with chief innovation officers. Oh, good. Those suckers over there, they're going to go innovate and they'll tell us if something comes out. As opposed to what Shane was saying, innovation is a matter of being an architect at the end of the day. And so it is with technology. Holly, you came from a different context. You were working in government. You were doing some unbelievable things with data that was making it available and accessible across a broad range of stakeholders. You came into Sasaki. And it's been kind of a baptism by fire over the last couple of years. Tell us what's been going on with you and about this idea of technology adoption among the folks at Sasaki.
Yeah, you know, I just want to say the Roberta and Shane's comments, I really, really agree with what they said. And I think the whole industry is really experiencing those sort of growing pains. And, you know, I think all of our firms really experienced growing pains this year. Whether we were ready or not for remote work, even if you thought you were ready and you had your technology all in place, sometimes our workplace culture was not. And I do think, you know, often we talk about technology, we often forget that the most powerful piece around technology are the human beings and the workflow and the process and the culture. And so one of the things we did work on early in the quarantine was really thinking about and how to redefine and help people understand what a remote work culture looks like and how do we maintain that sort of creative collaboration and fire. Sasaki is so, you know, so rich with, and how do we do that remotely when we're not side by side? So we've been working on moving to the cloud, moving everything to the cloud, and as well as we've been looking at how to really improve, in particular, the way that we do illustration, sketching, and drawing together collaboratively, but not in the same place, and how to really follow that through our workflow and identify pain points and remove barriers. So that's been a really interesting journey for me as, you know, started out as a planner and then was with the state looking at data and also digital interactions, really looking at how do you really ease those friction points for people and make it easier to do their day-to-day work. I think also the piece that we're all starting to really better understand is that we need to be perpetual newbies. And this gets back to the point that Shane was talking a little bit about. Every year, every day, we need to be learning new technology. And it's not that we're just going to use this one drafting software, this one illustration software or design software. We have to think about, well, this is good for that, and this other piece is a good approach. And how am I building my skills towards the next shift? I think what's a challenge for us as IT leaders is how and when do we invest our resources, both our human power as well as our financial power, to invest in where. And one of the things that some of the questions I've been posing is really about where do we want our creativity as architects, designers, and planners to go? Do do we really need to rethink the way that we write Word documents or, you know, our basic productivity suite? Or do we really want to focus on how are we engaging communities when we're planning a neighborhood, and what's that interactivity look like in a remote work environment? Or different dashboards for planning space to help people really understand what the new future of their office space will look like and what are scenarios. And so really just thinking about what is our value add in Sasaki, and then how does technology really lift that up, accelerate it, and keep us learning every day.
Nick, you're sitting in a unique spot, huge global firm, innovation at the center of the work that you do. How are you dealing with this challenge of innovative adoption across Perkins and Will? And what are you seeing as in related to your colleagues and some of the things that they've added here?
All the things that Holly just mentioned, I was like, yes, culture, yes, planning, yes, delivery, yes, you know, office documentation, dashboards. It just made me think we are doing so much. There's not one of those tasks mentioned that we're not focusing on. We hope that we don't go too thin. But I think for us that I'd like to think that we're thriving. And it is part of because we were thrown into this and we had to. And we've been able to accelerate, you know, our digital transformation of how people are working. But something that really struck me today, in particular, because we were on going after work, and it's the highs and the lows, and where technology can't fill the void, and that is still being remote. And what I mean by that is, if you win a project, you celebrate the same way over a Zoom call. And if you lose the job, you can't console one another through Zoom. So it's this really tough thing that we're trying to balance between how do we do the work, deliver the drawings or the models or the presentation, then how do we actively support one another as an organization, as a team? And I think that's the thing that is the biggest struggle right now still. The day-to-day, we're delivering. We haven't missed any deadlines. What we'd like to talk about is we went from 26 studios to 2,600 in a week in March, and we didn't miss a beat. But we're still struggling with how do we actively team and have those human moments.
Mm-hmm. At Design Intelligence, we often make this statement. You may have heard it before. We believe that all authentic innovation that is sustainable and defensible springs from the wellhead of research. That good innovation, and particularly at the technology side, since that's our subject matter today, really comes out of this idea, this wellspring of research. And so all of your organizations have either formal and informal research initiatives going on. Budgets have been allocated toward research. Sometimes it's allocated in the budgets of the technology people. Other times it's completely unrelated over in some of the practices and the domains. But the question is what's the connection you're seeing in your organizations between the technology and the research in driving new design outcomes? That is authentic innovation that's really changing the game in how you as a firm or even outside of your borders across industry, this marriage between research and technology innovation. Anybody want to take a shot at that?
I think the way that we operate here is we do have research. It's its own arm, but we're very much interconnected. And the way that John Haymaker is the director of research at Perkins and Will, we think of ourselves at two ends of the table, where John is maybe 5 years into the future, and then our team is looking at how do we implement that into practice. So there's this constant dialogue and test back and forth as to what will make a difference or how big of an impact can that be? And we try to relate what we're seeing on the ground today. And then John's bringing this, you know, oracle of the future. And we're looking for those connections. And some hit and some miss, but that's how we continue to move forward.
Yeah, I mean, I can say from our side, we put something in. I've been sort of wrestling with this for a long time. How do you sort of pull in grassroots innovation, attach it to real outcomes, let people be creative. So we have a reasonably small tech team, and we created a program called Friends of Tech. Anybody can be a friend of tech. Some are distant relatives, some are closer family members. If they're doing something interesting, we invite them in, we reach out, we look at who's doing work. They don't have to, it's completely optional. And we invite them to a lot of our strategic tech events. Shane actually spoke at our last one. where in addition to our reasonable sized team, we have 50, 60 friends of tech. And we keep in touch with them. We bring resources. We figure out where in the firm we can help them get resources if they're doing something on a project. And for me, you know, after trying many years of how do you actually inspire this, it's actually working really, really well to get groups of people who wouldn't necessarily be connected with tech actually part of our team, but not really part of our team, sort of billing on client projects. And, you know, we do silly things like when we had our tech retreat, they all got gifts from the tech team. And so they feel close to us, but they're also on projects. They know that if they want to call us, they can get some help. And it's those projects and the applied research they're doing, which really drive the firm to determine what we're going to invest in formally. I think in some of our cases, and ours for sure, we're not large enough to have a real large budget for formal research. So we really have to be thoughtful and mindful about where we sort of invest in research at a more formal university level. And we do that, but it's really largely driven on project work. And a lot of that is coming through our friends of tech. So we kind of keep everyone connected. So at the moment, it's working really well. And it continues to expand as we find more people doing all sorts of interesting stuff that our little tech team was unaware of.
Yeah, fantastic.
So, Dave, can I add something to that, please?
Yeah, please.
I think there are two points that I'd like to add is that, you know, I think tech and research are really help enable designers to ask better questions rather than simply focusing on a specific answer, which is something I think we often all fall into. And better design really doesn't come through the computation, but through asking better questions and then sort of understanding the answer and the intent that's coming back from the work that you do. And so I just think that's research really can focus the questions that we're asking and have us interrogate the ideas that we share with our clients and really think about how and what are the options as we move forward in the solutions. And then the second point would be that I think research and the technology is sort of a lost leader if we don't really understand how to pull whatever we've innovated into the rest of our work. So one of the things that I'm working on at Sasaki, because we have a great team, a strategies team, a really great group of data scientists and computer programmers, is we're talking about what is our innovation pipeline? So that we all have a shared framework for how does innovation happen at Sasaki? What do we do? What are the gates we have to clear to get move something from like an innovative beta test to, you know, being incorporated into the standard procedures? And, you know, how do we measure return on value or return on investment? And so I think innovation pipeline is something that the architecture field has not really thought about. We sort of have these one-off sparks that happen, but then how does it really transform the way that you do your work or the firm? And then how do you get that going and keep that pipeline filled? I think we need to get really good at that.
I couldn't agree with you more. I see this regularly, what you call these sparks of innovation, but not a consistent pipeline, not a discipline toward innovation, though I see it a lot within the engineering ranks. They're very ordered, very structured in their application of innovation, almost like a factory, of whether they're leaps or whether they're incremental adjustments. They're constantly innovating in their processes. And I'm hoping that we'll adopt some of that.
You make an interesting point. I would say that in some of the engineering practices, there are different types of problems that they're trying to solve. The sort of solution space that they're working within can be better defined, or often can be better defined. It's not always the case, but the solution space they're working in has relatively defined edges and kind of a clear definition of what success looks like. I think a lot in architectural practice as having a kind of an experiential sort of art dimension of it can be quite difficult in there. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where sometimes we run into some nervousness of referring to the work in an architectural practice as research, especially research with a capital R. I often get a bit skeptical of, say, architectural or specifically project-based research, because it's research that's put out there, but is much more grounded in novelty rather than necessarily in making a systemic change within a practice. And that's really where I get a lot more interested, is looking beyond what an individual project can do and how can that scale, how can that mm-hmm. be spread across multiple projects in our company. And I think specifically each of our practices also always want to consider, how does that research have to do with our vision? You know, it's specifically with Woods Bagot, our focus is around this term we refer to as people architecture, has a lot to do with user experience in space. So how is our research guiding us in that particular direction? I think back to, you know, what Holly mentioned before, this idea about asking better questions. I think this is absolutely perfect, because I always keep thinking about how innovation thrives through connectivity. It's not done through a separate team whose job it is to go off and do that. And I'm, you know, you can't see me here in my studio right now, but I'm raising my hand as someone who actually has the word innovation in their title. It's not my job. My job is actually to connect people, to hear what's going on in various projects or studios or amongst different groups, and do what I can across all these different disciplines and ideas and perspectives and connect people up as much as possible. Because through that, that exposure, that diversity of people that we have, that's where you start asking better questions. And you can start leading towards what Holly was talking about with an innovation pipeline, something that's continuous. The last thing I want to say is that I'm not saying that innovation can't happen within a core group and that there isn't some benefit of having a focus group. I think that's actually quite important. It's just a different version. It's an applied research. And that core group, their job is to serve as a force multiplier. We've got project teams that are running blazing fast. They have ideas. They sometimes need support from teams that can run at a different pace or a different cadence to get things done. Or when they're off, the projects are having to do other things, those separate groups can keep doing that research, keep developing those tools, those new workflows and processes. I'm thinking kind of specifically my reference point that for this is, you know, looking back to what Ed Cotmull talked about in his book, Creativity Inc. There's this whole kind of conversation about how the artists themselves working at Disney and Pixar were very much interested in applied technologies, and they would develop prototypes and ideas, but you had to have this group go to the side that wasn't necessarily on that same deadline to develop some of those core pieces and provide that back to the company. So there's a constant relationship between those core research groups and the project teams. They need to communicate as much as possible. The very last thing I want to say is, and this is a bit of a challenge and maybe goes a bit to your first question about adoption and innovation and how we're not really moving at the rate of other industries, we're not very good at sharing our research. We like to hold everything back as if it is, you know, this is our value proposition. This is our special value that our individual firm provides to particular clients. And I think it's actually to our detriment in many areas. I think specifically about topics around global impact and sustainability. There's been some firms out there, some on this call right now, that have been great about sharing their research. But I don't think we're quite as good as quite a lot of other industries at doing that same work. Again, to reference the work at Pixar and them, a lot of them, different companies, were working with each other, sharing their research paper, sharing technologies, open sourcing different platforms, and it helped the whole industry move that way. And I really think our industry and all the kind of adjacent industries, specifically around software and everyone else, really needs to get better about topics of sharing, interoperability, about research transparency.
Boy, you are singing my song, I tell you. And quite frankly, most of what is called research ends up as marketing communications fodder and is not driving systemic, as you use the term, Shane, systemic change and innovation within organizations. So our call at DI is going to be toward this new level of dropping this false sense of competitive intelligence that we have the secret sauce with our finding, and realizing that by the open sharing of our research, extraordinary things will happen and everyone wins when we reposture ourselves in a different way. So boy, thanks for tripping my trigger there. You really did it. It's a big thing. Anyone want to add into that?
Yeah, Dave, I'll sort of make a comment. You know, your sort of conclusion there where everyone wins. What you're describing is sort of how Shopify would describe their commerce platform, where every small, you know, commercial enterprise on Shopify wins and Shopify wins. And I will say that there's a parallel to be made in our industry, you know, related to sort of the sharing of our knowledge. I can say that our team, I have several sort of sub teams that want to share what we're doing. And for us to build a platform to share it on is really not in the main sort of work of what we do. And there's not a lot of sort of methods for us to share, especially the technology work, without necessarily, say, going through some of these, I'm going to say, industry giants. And I think you guys know who I'm talking about. It's just the nature of our business, which we have a single large monopoly software company, which in some cases isn't necessarily helping us share the little pieces of innovation. It sort of gets sucked into a big platform. And then, you know, each of us is using that in different ways. Contrasted with sort of the platform strategies that are coming out of other types of industries that are winning, I think there's a few things on the horizon in our industry related to platforms and the sharing of information and putting the infrastructure in place, which are really interesting. I know, for example, even in construction, where Procore positions themselves as a neutral platform that they can share information on across the industry with large and small players. I'm hopeful and wishing that we would see a little bit more of that so that the sharing and the infrastructure needed to share was a little bit more available. I'm talking technology specifically, not ideas, which is another question. But I think this whole concept of platforms and how industries mature around platforms, financial industries, the ad platforms I used in media, and we don't really have a design platform that's open where everyone wins. And so I think maybe there's something to think about there.
Great thinking. So we've also been talking quite a bit over the last few months that really became headlines that we are forcing to stay as headlines, and that is equity, sustainability, healthiness. These are what we believe to be inextricably tied to one another. Social equity, sustainability as in our environment, and healthiness for humans in whatever place or context that they find themselves. How are you, as technology leaders, applying your insight, your intelligence, your extraordinary expertise toward driving equity, sustainability, and healthiness through the practices that you're operating within?
So we're working closely with our resiliency leaders, resiliency team within Perkins and Will. And what we're trying to bring is our expertise around what do you do with the data that's available, census data, material data? How do we turn that into dashboards, or how do we put that out for teams to try to understand? And then how will we measure our work as we're designing it and put it out there into the world? So there's an effort, has been an effort underway at Perkins and Will for way before I've been here to make that easier and to give our design teams, our designers, that information right at their fingertips. And just make it part of the process.
It's fantastic. Empowering the design on the front end. Others?
I'd like to jump in on this one a bit. There's a few things that I think we are looking at here. For one thing, this has been something that's been kind of near and dear to my heart. Specifically, I'm thinking about the diversity aspects of our industry itself. We've been having a lot of conversations within Woods Bagot about it, and I've been having just a lot of kind of thoughts and conversations with my colleagues, specifically within design technology on this. You know, speaking as a white male, I am the most common kind of look of what our industry has out there. So there's been a lot of conversations within our practice in terms of how we're hiring people and how we're bringing people in, but also trying to support all the way back towards, you know, thinking about high school students and their kind of interest of getting into architecture. Because we can have a lot of conversations around things like social equity, sustainability, healthiness, and that sort of space. But if it's the same group of people having the conversations and having it for the last few decades, I'm not as confident as much change could possibly happen than when we bring in a more diversity in the views and the people who are part of those conversations. So one thing is I think we need to change our industry itself so we have more people and a diverse group of people in those conversations. I think the second part of this is that we have been spending some time building, you know, some applications. We've been really taking advantage of some of the open source systems out there, like the Ladybug tools. Been working very closely with that group and building some of our tools on top of that and trying to contribute to it as much as possible. Because again, that's a, you know, to the previous conversation about supporting research and transparency and sharing what we're doing, opportunities to help out open source initiatives and groups that are trying to do this very publicly, we should all be doing that as much as possible. But we, you know, we've been building some of our analysis tools on top of things like Ladybug and trying to build them into Rhino and Revit and to make it as present as part of almost an informed or augmented design environment as possible. So this idea of a feedback loop about building performance, about social or spatial performance, you know, the experience of people in space, is as immediate and quick as possible. Things like analysis aren't a separate step that happens on the side, but is instead a constantly informing thing as part of your design process. In the same way that you're used to looking at the visuals in a 3D model and pulling up something in VR and Enscape. But I think the other part of this is that you can do all that, but it may still not drive actual change in your practice. So we've been going through and looking at every phase of our work, from the initial project inception and the conversations that we're having with our clients and consultants to set our aspirations about what sort of impact this project is going to make to be, you know, as climate positive and as kind of human positive as possible here, all the way into how that integrates into our design reviews and what kind of information is provided in a design review so we can actually evaluate how we're performing. And then further into how it manifests in construction, and then also into what do we learn from our exemplars? How do we take that knowledge learned from that project and make sure that it makes its way back into the rest of the practice and is available information, and again, as publicly as possible to people. So we've been in the process of developing a system to actually track that and to kind of walk people along that journey where it's not just a matter of checkboxes, but it's a series of prompts and a series of engagements where we are having this topic around global impact permeate every aspect of our design process. It's not, again, treated like a separate task that someone else is supposed to do or something that only shows up every once in a while, but instead is threaded through the fabric of our traditional services and the work that we do within our studios.
Oh, it's powerful. And inviting that diversity of opinion and insight into that work stream, right? So that you do get more than the male, pale, stale perspective.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dave, can I just add a few points?
Yeah, please, Holly.
So there's a lot of similarities between some of the efforts that we're doing and others, but just a few things. One is in terms of the piece that I do have the most control over, which is IT hiring, really starting to look at building the relationship with different organizations who can help diversify our workforce. And so we've been starting conversations with a group called Resilient Coders, which is a group here in Boston, and they work with folks who have non-traditional backgrounds and teach them how to code and do work that would really help us and as we're developing our different applications. Sort of another avenue that people were just talking about was the looking at sort of dashboards and indicators on all of our projects around sustainability. We have Tamar Warburg is really great in leading that work for us. Really looking at our sustainability, not just in terms of the classic environmental indicators, but also thinking about sustainability in terms of community sustainability, you know, some of the indicators that get more towards equity. And then finally, through the Sasaki Foundation, where we have some great work around mobility and the mobility innovator tool that we've put together. Wendell Joseph is leading some great planning work with two of our communities here in Metro Boston to really help them understand, you know, the 15-minute community and what does it take to have a whole and healthy community and how to help people plan for that. So those are just some of the examples of the way that Sasaki is looking at equity.
So I think, you know, when we think about the sustainability or the resiliency of what we're building, it goes back to some of your earlier questions and what Shane had brought up about around sharing. And if you take the concept of how do we measure CO2 as we're designing, that's an app that we should all work on together to develop as a whole for the industry. It's something that we all need. We're probably all developing something in one form or another with some partners or another, like the E3 tool or, you know, buying these things like Tally. And that's a place where it's one cause that we could all work together on, I feel, and get something out there. And not just for the big firms, but for all the firms, the small firms and everyone else.
It's honestly not a competitive advantage. And people think, if I do it myself, I've got this edge, and it's just not.
We lovingly call those kind of, you know, the baseline apps, the hubcap apps, because we kind of all need them, but we don't think they're a competitive advantage.
Wouldn't that be something if we could all agree to that? Quick story. A few years ago, a dear friend of mine who is a wood craftsman gave me a present. He went into my basement for a week and built a wall of a wine cabinet for me. It's unbelievable, right? And I would come home and I would see his work each time. And I just thought, this is the coolest thing on the planet. And I looked at all of his tools. And so when he was about finished, I said, Tim, what tools would I need to build something like that? So he pulls out all of his tools, which are worn and tired and messed up. And he says, well, you want this, and you want this, and you want this. So I take this list, and my daughters and my wife end up for Christmas buying me a whole set of these tools. Beautiful. They're shiny. They're really cool. I've never built anything with them because I have no idea what I'm doing with this toolbox of these tools, right? It's extraordinary. It's very much what we're seeing in technology today. We're seeing people with their own little boxes of tools that really don't know how to leverage them appropriately. so that there can be a larger impact. And it's this idea, why don't we have a consortium of common problems that we can just brainstorm together, resolve together, and succeed together? Again, it's a rhetorical question, but we must create this type of venue.
To maybe kind of take off on what does it mean to kind of collaborate as an industry? What does it mean to innovate individually within our firms? I'm thinking about the various scales that we can operate in here. You've got individual projects that are going to innovate, do something interesting. You've got to think about how what is learned from that project, the knowledge gained through that, the tools developed, the processes that are explored, can then expand across a particular practice, become something systemic. And ideally, they don't become overgeneralized, that they lose that edge or they lose that that intensity that you'd be looking for. But then even beyond that, you've got to think about, well, how does that then extend further out in the industry itself, such that the work that individual studio does or individual project does can scale to a studio or a company and can scale all the way to the industry itself. And what I'm finding really exciting is something that I got a taste of this at least 15, 16 years ago, when I first started getting involved in topics around design computation. You know, computation being this kind of overall ethos or kind of conceptual approach that says you don't necessarily accept the tools and the design environments that are handed to you, but you augment and you adapt and you extend and you build your own. You know, design your own design space, your exploration space. What I appreciate is now we've got a whole industry building up out of this idea. You've got companies like HiPar, you've got open source platforms like Speckle that are all operating in this exact same sort of space about extendability, about creating your own design space. And each of those, you know, HiPar thinking about this idea that you can, you know, create expertise or create tools that can be made publicly available. I think Ian has even put a few out there on their own to say, none of you should ever have to build this one again because we see them in the same studios again and again. Instead, here it is for free. Go innovate on something that can make a real impact then. And then you've got Speckle as an open source initiative that wants active contribution. We spent some time contributing to that as well. I find the whole thing quite fascinating and exciting. And I think for me, what we need to do is start structurally kind of shifting our firms to wrap around this idea and contribute to that idea. I'm always excited about empowering project teams to develop their own project-based prototypes of new workflows, new tools, and systems. And that's core to this approach to computation. That's where I began 15 years ago at Grimshaw Architects, building computational tools to do various projects that we are on. But then thinking about how that then scales up in an organization, you do need people who take those apps pro, who generalize them, make them a little bit more robust, maybe add some capabilities and really spread them out through an organization as kind of almost a design op sort of approach. And you will even sometimes partner with external developers to do that type of thing. But then you scale up even beyond that. You want those same people contributing to those open source initiatives, the Ladybugs, the Speckles of the world. You want them building tools using some of the new kit that's been available and thinking about the modernization of the AEC software industry in the same way that we watched the modernization of the web industry, moving from the kind of walled garden approaches of the CompuServes and Prodigies of the world that I grew up on with my modem, all the way to what we have now as open source and commercial frameworks and systems and extensions and tools able to communicate with each other in a very wide way. So I get really excited about that. I get worried when I don't see practices thinking about that as an opportunity. And again, thinking about technology as a necessary evil rather than as a strategic asset. But I do get excited that our practice is making that transition. And I also get excited about how much opportunities that I have for collaboration with others to build things. Because it's that vitality I get out of that computational approach that gives me some optimism that we are at a position to make some real change in the industry.
Well, fantastic. Inspiring words. Others?
I think on that last thread about the tools around on the web is kind of interesting, where the same building websites and I think it was Dreamweaver back in the day and knowing a little bit about HTML, when I say that, it means I knew how to copy and paste things together, but then almost to the commoditization of Wix or Squarespace. And I think that's maybe what scares some people, is that what our firms are doing and what we're designing for our clients is not for commodity. We're building for brands. We're building for our clients, things that are very special and bespoke. And it goes all the way back to the first question around, you know, how efficient are we, or why aren't we adopting faster? And I think part of it is what we do is bespoke. And I hope that doesn't change, because it seems like it would be very boring. The idea that Roberta was talking about from design, from couture to what H&M does now. I don't really want to do that. I'm kind of more into the design and what we bring as value to our clients. I do think the tools should change. They should become easier for certain things. But, you know, design is hard. It's iterative. It's a little messy and fun. And I hope that doesn't get taken out by, you know, the thought of what I really is a term I don't like is generative design. That to me, just what you see is some really awful stuff just 1,000 times over. And it takes someone really at the center, or a group of people at the center, to design things that inspire our clients and what we build and put out there in the world.
Great. Roberta, any adds on to what your colleagues are saying?
So to be clear, if I had a choice personally over a couture dress versus one made at H&M, I'd go for the couture every time. So I absolutely respect and love the work that great design firms do. And I don't think it'll ever disappear in this world. There certainly is a place for more mass market, you know, affordable housing and buildings that can happen faster to meet needs or other business outcomes. But hopefully the repetitive nature of sort of that is clear to everybody. But it is important for what we do to take the repetitive tasks out so we free up more time for design. And that's the efficiency piece, which sometimes the artisans in our world don't really think that way. Not that they don't want to, they just think design, not sort of efficiency. And so I think there's kind of a tension there. Also, just a quick comment on build versus buy, because again, I'm fairly new to this industry. In the media business that I was in before, I can't count on one hand the amount of software that we built. We bought everything, and we built and managed large websites for one of the largest media companies in the US, and everything in that website was, you know, some kind of a component we had added. And so it's been really interesting joining this industry, seeing kind of how much we're building. And I would say many times we're building a lot of things that are already available in the market. And our senior people should be saying to the teams that really want to build, why are you building that? Just go buy this. It's faster, and I need you doing other things. But by nature, we are an industry of builders. We like to build, and my firm has got a number of engineers. They like to learn this stuff. And so there's also that kind of tension of what we'd like to build. But it's been really interesting to see sometimes way more getting built when I can see something in the market. And I'll even say, hey, guys, there's something out here we could buy and start using tomorrow. And there's always a question of what we build and what we buy. So there's some industry learning to be done as well, I think, in terms of maturing how you build and buy and use something that's maybe not perfect.
No, I absolutely agree with you. And I think there's often a miss on the classic idea of total cost of ownership. And so we talk about building things, which, again, are wonderful to do. They exercise our minds. But the ongoing support, maintenance, iteration, maturity of built products often get kicked to the curb because we don't have the stick-to-itiveness to support them, and certainly don't often with the dedication of budgets accordingly. And so you're bringing up a tremendous question, and that is, how do we make the best decisions between build in-house, build in partnership, outsource a build, or just go out and buy? And so there's a continuum. I'm sure there's a few other steps along that continuum that we need to consider. Holly, bring us home. Talk to us about what it is that you want to see in this industry when it comes to this adoption and I'll say proper exploitation of technology toward positive and good ends.
Yeah, you know, I think we're ending in a really great spot in terms of such a salient conversation for everybody who's looking at investing in tech and architecture and in architecture firms. And, you know, I think this gets back to the concept that we've all been sort of batting around in different ways, that I think we don't have a shared framework between the technology folks and the innovative programmers and then the designers and the artistic souls that they have. We don't have a shared framework for innovation. And when we have these really, you know, scarce but really important research dollars or dollars to develop something, you know, really think about, if we only have two things we can do this year, what are those two things going to be? How do they support our business goals? Where we really want to put our effort and make a difference? Is it really that we're going to figure out how to you know, scan something quicker? Or is it that we really want to figure out how to engage more people around the table who speak multiple languages or whatever the question might be? And so I think we often have, in technology, we often skip over the values question and the goals question. And I think we really need to stay front and center with the business in those conversations and help them interpret their values and goals into our technology decisions and really helping them understand, look, this is a target-rich environment. We can buy things all over the place. We can build things all over the place. There's some places where we just should get consumer off the shelf, and there's some places where we really should put our special creative energies and lenses towards, and let's invest our resources there. And I think that's a conversation we're not very good at having as an industry.
This has been a fabulous conversation, and we've only gotten started. It's been extraordinary. We might have to get the band back together and do this again at another time. Thank you so much. It's been an honor to have you with us at This Is Design Intelligence.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of This Is Design Intelligence, sponsored by the Tricord Group and VIM. The producer for This Is Design Intelligence is Laura Spells. Sound engineering by Jared Knabel. This has been a DI Media Group production.